Hello there, listeners of Bylines Network Podcast. Welcome to our sixth episode of the podcast, and only our third about by-elections. I'm definitely not seeing a pattern here. I am joined by Chris Davis and a member from Byline Scotland, if you want to introduce yourself.
I'm Martin Roach.
Nice to meet you, Martin. So, let's talk about politics. So, Martin, since the Scottish by-election was first, I feel like it's only fitting if you go first.
Yeah. The Scottish by-election was first. It was the first by-election in Scotland to result from a recall petition. There is sitting SNP Member of Parliament had been found guilty of breaking COVID regulations, quite a major breach of COVID regulations, but otherwise she was generally considered to be a assiduous and decent constituency MP, but there's absolutely no doubt that the forces of Labour and the Conservatives in Westminster, that they would take full advantage of this position, and they suspended her for 6 weeks, which, as many of your listeners know, is enough to trigger a petition. And so Labour went to work on a petition and gained the necessary 10,000 signatures. Rutherglen and Hamilton West was a very long established Labour constituency, but it's moved, it's vacillated a bit over the years. Of course, Hamilton itself goes way back to 1967 and the very famous victory of Winnie Ewing in that very famous by-election, where she beat Labour to become not the first, but the first of the modern era SNP MPs. So Labour threw absolutely everything at the Rutherglen by-election. I live quite near, and I think they had something like 30. There's only one, of course, Labour MP in Scotland. And I think they had 30 Labour MPs drafted up from England, plus a fairly massive, the entire effort of the Scottish Labour Party was put behind it. And they probably deservedly won. They put the energy and the effort and the time and the money into it. And the SNP, of course, has been a bit deflated of recent times. But I don't think they were expecting quite the size of the victory that Labour recorded. And there's various reasons for that. One, obviously, Labour has its wins in its sails at a UK-wide level. And obviously this SNP government in Scotland has been in power now for 15 years and therefore has made lots of errors and stacked up lots of scandals and difficulties, and the loss of Nicola Sturgeon has an impact. The issue surrounding SNP expenses, which I have to say in my view is probably going to be an absolute non-event, but nonetheless it's given the press a great deal to talk about, and it's one of the great disadvantages of the SNP when it comes to Westminster elections, that it's actually fighting two elections. It's fighting people's perceptions of the Edinburgh government and their perceptions of national politics. I think also there's the thought, which exists, of course, in many parts of England as well, that we'd rather get rid of this Conservative government. There's an opportunity here to do something and do that. Now, the longer-term effects for the SNP, we'll have to wait and see. I mean, what people think, and isn't entirely true, is that Labour need Scotland to win. Tony Blair didn't need Labour Scotland to win in 1997. He didn't need them to win in 2002. He did need them to. He could have done this, and he did quite well in Scotland in the last general election that he fought. But if the polls are right and the numbers are sustained, until the general election happens, he doesn't need Scotland to win. What he needs to win in Scotland is to win Scotland. Is to hold back the tide of the SNP, because despite the fact that the SNP's numbers are significantly down, they are still the most popular party in Scotland. They're still the favoured party for the Edinburgh Parliament, which has got 3 years to run, 2 or 3 years to run. Independence numbers have stayed up despite the fall off in popularity and the loss of Nicola Sturgeon. And the concern, I don't know if you're aware of this in England, but the Conservatives pay used public money to do a lot of polling research, private polling research in Scotland, and have consistently refused to publish these figures, despite being told to do so by the courts.
Martin, if you could just answer a question that I thought of before
sure.
this. At the 2017 election, or 2019, I saw that the Lib Dem leader at the time lost her seat because she was a Scottish Lib Dem member. And they said that, and the reason I remember this is because Nicola Sturgeon was seen like celebrating, like pumping the air or kind of stuff. And I read that the reason she was celebrating was because all of the Scottish seats, at least as far as Westminster is concerned, are marginal. Is this still true today? And does this mean that, you know, Labour won't have to fight all that hard for representation in Scotland?
You do get the seats where there's a personal vote. And particularly the further north you go, the more that has been the position for a century. People like Alistair, God, his name is, who's in Stornoway. I mean, he's the Lib Dem. He's just going to be there forever because that's what they like. In the Western Isles, there's a very strong possibility that the sitting independent member now, the man who's left the SNP, could lose his seat. There are seats that the SNP will almost certainly definitely hold. The bizarre thing is, of course, there's a very strong possibility the SNP will take the six Tory seats, and of course they're all in rural areas where, you know, 40 years ago there wasn't a chance of an SNP vote. But that's one of the things that Alex Salmond changed. He managed to convince people in rural and fishing communities a vote for the SNP was worthwhile. It's impossible to say this. My instinct would be, if you held a general election tomorrow, the SNP could lose 30 seats, and that would obviously not put them in a strong position to fight the Edinburgh general election after that.
It's really interesting that you say that, because obviously, I mean, Scottish politics is so different to Westminster politics, and like you were talking about, the relationship between the elected members and the constituents is really personal, which you don't always get. You know, people vote for their constituency MPs or representatives, but also for the party leader. So I wonder, obviously the SNP have a new party leader now. Do you think that part of this loss could be put at Humza Yousaf's door, or has he not had enough time yet to have that put at his door?
I think the latter is probably true, but actually there's not very much can be put at Humza Yousaf's door. He's doing all right. Clearly you see the press is out of control in most of the UK and is fiercely right wing. You see it's magnified in Scotland. I mean, I'm only back in Scotland a couple of years. When I left Scotland 35 years ago, nobody read the Daily Mail. It's the biggest selling middle market paper in Scotland. There was no Scottish edition of the Times. There is now. There's no Scottish edition of the Telegraph. There is now. Plus all the traditional papers.
And of course, Byline Scotland. By the way, subscribe to Byline Scotland.
Oh, thank you very much. There's the National, which is the pro-independence paper founded in the wake of the 2014 election. A bit like the New European. Nobody expected it to survive. But it has. The real issue in Scottish politics is the tragedy that the SNP's policies are policies that most Labour activists and Labour MPs would like to have.
Yeah.
The SNP is a classic European social democratic party in the Harold Wilson, Attlee type mould, where it's being forced into a position of being further to the right. And of course, the big issue will be all over the country, all over the UK, of course, will be turnout. Can people be bothered? And also the issue of voter identification. So will Scotland make a huge difference to the general election? Probably not, if the numbers are sustained. Is there a problem for Starmer if he becomes a prime minister? I'm sure he will. Yes, without a shadow of a doubt, independence is not going to go away. But nonetheless, there will be great issues. The one of the greatest issues which is a reprise of the 1970s and 1980s, is that Scotland's wind power. Scotland exports about 60 or 70% of its daily electricity generated, and then it's exported back to Scotland where they're charged more than what people pay in Bristol. And it's a growing issue, and it'll grow over the summer, over the winter, of course. So, yeah, fascinating times here. The SNP's big issue is that, and it's tried to get to grips with this, but I'm not sure it quite has. I was, for other reasons, at the SNP conference in Aberdeen. It's got to make the idea, people are sold on the idea of independence, but they've got to give them a vision of what that will look like, what that will mean in their daily lives, and make it credible and achievable. And I don't think they've achieved that yet.
So that was the first of the three by-elections. And now we go on to Chris, who I believe was looking very carefully at Tamworth.
Yes, Tamworth. There were two by-elections on the 19th of October, and Jules will talk about the next one. It's worth framing both of them with one sentence. And Martin already mentioned Professor Sir John Curtis earlier. But I'm going to start off with a quote that he gave, I think it was on the Friday morning after, where he said, this may be one of the worst nights any government has endured because of the results that have come out. But starting off in Tamworth, I'm sure as we may all be familiar, but for those who weren't, this by-election was triggered by the resignation of the MP Chris Pincher, who was the Conservative MP at the time. This was also not... It wasn't a recall petition, but there was a risk of there being one. And Chris Pincher decided to sort of quit before it got to that stage. He quit as an MP after losing an appeal against an 8-week suspension. And that was for, I believe it was being, he groped people at a private members club.
To quote our former prime minister, and I still can't believe I can say that sentence, Boris Johnson, Pincher by name, Pincher by nature.
Yeah. And I mean, this his his behavior can be said to have played quite a pivotal role in Boris Johnson actually being brought down as prime minister. So the seat Tamworth itself is an interesting one. It's historically been a very strong Conservative seat, and actually the Conservatives do better, they tend to do better in this seat than they do across the UK generally in terms of vote share. And even if Labour, they have had a Labour MP at some point in the past, the Tory vote has often stood up. It wasn't the case this time around. So Labour saw a swing of 23.9% towards them, and that meant that Sarah Edward is the new Labour MP for Tamworth. And the scale of that swing, I think it was the second largest post-war election swing. So there's not really been a swing like this in a very long time. And Tamworth, like I was saying earlier, was fairly consistent in its Conservative support. It was the 57th safest Conservative seat. So it wasn't quite up there, but it was fairly high. And there wasn't really any expectation that Labour would win this, but they did. Some of the reasons for that... you know, the Conservatives will say the personal factor of the MP being accused of quite awful behaviour. Yep, fine. But Tamworth also has a really high percentage of homeowners and new homeowners. So there's a discussion to be had about whether people switched away from the Conservatives due to the increased interest rates. Because we've talked about this on previous podcasts. I think it was when we did a previous by-election special. they're not specials anymore, if there's been more than one, I suppose. In Selby and Ainsty, the same sort of effect was seen. That also had quite a high homeowning percentage of population, and that the swing to Labour then was blamed for the increase in interest rates. So it's interesting to look at that. There was something that I thought was worth mentioning, and if the Tory candidate did win at this election after saying what he said, I would be quite surprised. There was a Facebook post that was uncovered, I think, by the Daily Mirror, where the Conservative candidate, told parents who can't feed their kids to F off. he then proceeded to defend that Facebook post, justifying it by saying there are too many people on out-of-work benefits and there needs to be improved incentives to get people to work. But I'm not entirely sure that telling people to F off is an incentive to get people into work. It's certainly an incentive to lose a by-election quite badly.
Martin.
And was he the man who disappeared from the count?
Yes, he did.
Yes, he was.
He was late to the count, and they nearly announced the results without him there because apparently he got lost in the car park. And then he walked off halfway, at the beginning of the speech that the elected candidate usually gives. So he can't...
Yeah, didn't even give off like the traditional shake of the hand, which I will have things to say about the Conservative candidate in mid-beds, but he at least gave his opponents that courtesy. I'll give him that much.
So, Chris, I have to confess, I've travelled widely across the UK, but I've never been to Tamworth. I don't know it at all. What happens there? I mean, what sort of place is it? It's obviously a traditional Tory place, but, you know, how does it make its living?
So Tamworth is a city in I think it's the West Midlands, and it's just outside of Birmingham. So it's
Staffordshire.
In terms of what industries are there, I can't say for sure.
According to Wikipedia, the town's industries include logistics, engineering, clothing, brick, tile, and paper manufacturer. And until 2001, one of the factories which produced Reliant Robin three-wheeler cars and the Reliant Scimitar sports car.
Of course.
So the Scimitar, yeah, absolutely. So what happened to the Lib Dem vote then?
Well, this was the other interesting part, and what happened with the other parties' votes. So the Lib Dems and the Greens didn't do too well. They both got under 500 votes each, but they haven't really historically really done very well in that seat anyway. So that wasn't too much of a shock. What was something to look at was the fact that the combined parties of Reform UK, UKIP and Britain First (Stop the Boats), because apparently that's what they're called now, won a combined vote of 9.4%. And even if all of those who voted Reform at this by-election voted Conservative, the seat would have stayed blue. The main reason Labour won this election from crunching the numbers is from people who've changed from Tory to Labour. But of course, by-elections are always not great on turnout. I think this was about 32%. So it wasn't... It may be entirely different than the general election. People may have at this election decided to protest their vote in a different way. And it'll be interesting to see what happens, because if the swing is consistent, and it seems like it has been in the last few by-elections towards Labour, it'll be interesting just to see if that maintains itself. And if it does, we'll be looking at a Labour government, I think, in 2024 or whenever the election will be.
So on to mid-beds, which is the area that I covered. And let me tell you, listeners, I had like this whole speech written because I was keeping my eye on the polls. I was keeping my eye on like all the channels talking about to people in mid-beds. And for all those who don't know, the polls were all saying that the Conservatives were going to win by 2% of the vote, with the left-wing vote split between the Liberal Democrats and Labour. And I had this whole speech written about how, you know, in some seats, we just need to put our differences aside and all that. And I had to throw all that out because Labour won by quite a significant margin. I really need to start learning the lessons of 2016 and stop listening to the polls.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you stop listening to the polls entirely, of course, you may end up with not believing in a Labour government's going to happen.
Yeah, well, that maybe in moderation. But yeah, the main concerns of this by-election were mainly focused on like what everyone else was talking about. Like, you know, recently in the constituency, there was some building sites set up. And what surprised me about that is that most of the reports that I saw weren't talking about how they didn't like those developments. If anything, everyone said, actually, we really like this. People need more homes. It's just that they were going, there's just no infrastructure to support them. Like, people were buying a house in these new allotments, and they would have to drive half an hour to get to their nearest doctor's appointment. If only there was like a 15-minute city scheme that people didn't fall for. But yeah, it was mostly about the cost of living. It was mostly about building sites and infrastructure for that. And the one thing that struck me is that a lot of people just wanted a voice back in Parliament again. Because Noreen Dorries, if I remember correctly, and I could be wrong about this, I have to be very careful, Nadine Dorries hadn't showed up in Parliament to vote for over a year, meaning that there were a good 70,000 odd people who just didn't have a voice in Parliament for a year. So that was not nice for them.
Did you get the impression that she had poisoned the Conservative well just by her behaviour?
I mean, there definitely was an element of that, I think. They lost 28% of their vote. So the last election in Mid-Beds was won by almost 60% of the votes to Labour's 21% of the votes, and about 31% of the vote voted for the Conservative Party. So I think it's definitely a lot more than what the Conservatives are blaming it on, which was Conservative voters staying home. But I do think, Martin, that there was a huge element of Noreen Dorries has just been terrible and the Conservatives haven't exactly been that much better.
Yeah.
I will say this, when the new MP got sworn into Parliament, Rishi Sunak told like the first funny joke I've ever heard him say, in which he addressed the new Mid-Beds MP and said, "I know that you'll probably support me a lot more than your predecessor." So good on you, Mr. Sunak. You told the funny.
The result in this seat was quite surprising, and I think it especially was for a lot of Labour campaigners as well. And I mean, there was quite an interesting write-up in The Spectator a couple of days after of when you initially do the groundwork for a campaign like that. And I think it was Peter Kyle, who's the MP for Brighton, and it might be Hove, actually. Hove in Brighton, I think he is. And he was sent up to Mid-Bedfordshire to sort of gauge support, and they weren't expecting big things. It was just, you know, we'll do what we can, but it's likely to be a hold or at best a Lib Dem gain. But apparently on the ground they found that there was a lot more switching to Labour from Conservative voters than they thought there was, and that meant that they put everything in it, they threw the kitchen sink at it, and it's turned out the result they wanted.
So absolutely, I mean, for those who don't know the geography, of course, I mean, Mid-Beds is essentially rural North London. You know, it's about 25 miles, 30 miles, just 5 miles beyond the M25. Absolutely affluent commuter belt, rock solid. You couldn't ask for a more traditional Tory seat. Leafy villages, cricket on the lawn, warm beer in the pub. Probably 98% white. Large houses and weekend cars, extra cars for the weekend. So, you know, if the Tories are losing there by that measure, it certainly doesn't augur for them. I mean, they didn't even lose seats like that in 97 with the Blair landslide. A lot of marginal Tory seats and some surprising Tory seats went, of course. But I see Lib Dems, and I don't think anybody was, I think it stayed solidly Tory. So that sort of result would be devastating for the Conservative Party. The point I think Joe's made earlier, though, that if there is a truth in the fact that the Tories, so a lot of Tory voters stayed at home, is that particularly Tory voters don't tend to stay at home for general elections. They do tend to, they see it as their duty to come out and vote. So it's almost certainly going to be a tighter seat. Come the general election, and I suppose theoretically, maybe more than theoretically, the Tories could win it back, but they would need. What the swing was enormous, I think, wasn't it? You said, Jules, didn't you?
Yeah, it went from 60% of the vote to 31% of the vote, so that's minus 28%. I don't know what that translates out to as swing. Speaking as like someone who grew up in Hertfordshire, my friends always made the joke that you could cross the border into Beds and Bucks and you wouldn't be able to tell the difference. It's very
Absolutely.
Very like typical middle England. If I was going to bet who was going to win there, other than the Conservatives, my money would have been on the Liberal Democrats, because the Liberal Democrats have like a much stronger base in rural England. The way I think about it, and by the way, Liberal Democrat voters listening, feel free to be offended by this, but the way I normally think about it is that the Liberal Democrats are the left-wing voter, the left-wing party for rural voters, who just go, well, yeah, people should just generally be nicer to each other, you know? So that's where my money was. I thought it was going to be... I honestly thought the results of this would have been the SNP barely holding on, Labour and the Liberal Democrats, but here we are with all three turned flipped red.
Yeah. No, well, that seems to be appear to be the trend, and there doesn't seem to be anything. Sunak's government doesn't appear to be doing anything to halt the slide, while still believing that the voters are on their side. At least still saying that. I mean, it's quite staggering. They must have private polling as well, which is telling them much the same, probably worse. Since those three by-elections, they haven't adopted any policies that would give people, Tory voters, confidence that they're doing something that captures people's imaginations or appears to be dealing with the key issues. They're just drifting along.
Yeah, like Rishi Sunak put out like those 5 points, you know, cut down on waiting lists, fix the economy, stop the small boats, all that kind of stuff. And I just have a feeling that if people had any confidence that he would be able to exercise these, people would still come out and show their support in by-elections. But that just hasn't happened. Like, you don't lose 28% of the votes in one of the most conservative areas in the country if voters don't vote for you. Or that's voters right. don't have yeah. confidence yeah. in you, you know?
I think there's two other things that might lie under the surface here, particularly for Tory areas. One, of course, is that house prices have declined. And this is quite a remarkable thing. I can't remember the last time this happened. Must be 30 years since there was a glitch in house prices. Now, most people in Midlands will live in extremely lovely houses, most with large amounts of equity. But nonetheless, people like to think, as the biggest purchase of their lives, that if they bought this house 25 years ago at £200,000, that it would be worth £1.7 million today. But if it's not worth £1.7 million, they feel, it's about how they feel. They may have no intention of moving, but if they feel their wealth has been reduced. And of course, the other thing, and I can attest for this personally, is that the trust disaster had a huge impact on private pension funds. They're down. I mean, mine is down 5%, directly a result of that activity. So if people in these places who are looking forward to comfortable retirements, and almost certainly will still have comfortable retirements, but if they feel that combination of bad economic policy combined with inflation and house price falls eating away at their essential wealth, then they're not going to, you know, that's what the Tories are meant to stand for as far as they're concerned, and clearly it's not working. So, you know, all over the country, there's not very much going for the Tories.
I think that moves us smoothly into the conclusion of this piece, which is, once again, third time round, what does this mean for a general election? And I think it's just going to be a case of same third verse, same as the first and second. In my opinion, if Labour can replicate these results in a general election, then we are probably looking towards like the Tories going down to double digit MPs. But again, this comes with the caveat of these are by-elections.
Yeah.
And people tend to feel the need to come out more for general elections because, you know, oh, we're actually making a decision on the leader of the country in theory. So I think this is a good sign for Labour. I do think that, as Martin said earlier, they will have to fight a bit more in a general election if they want to keep the seats.
Yeah. And of course, I can't recall now, but I think it was well down the list of target seats to get a majority, mid-beds. So even if they lost it, they still may well be returned with a. It looks as if at this stage in the world that they should get a majority, a healthy majority, a healthy working majority. And if they don't, they've got the Lib Dems to lean on, who almost certainly will do better. And they've got them to lean on. It may cost them a little bit here, a little bit there. We might win on, you know, we might see some wins on things like PR. But it would be surprising now if Starmer weren't the next Prime Minister.
I agree with what you both said. Barring a complete and utter catastrophic mess up, it's pretty difficult to see how a Labour government isn't going to be the next one that's elected at the next election. And I mean, discussing this prior to recording slightly, the state of the world is changing very quickly, as I'm sure we all know. That might impact it somewhat, but like I say, I think it was going to take something catastrophic in order to change that, and I don't think that will happen ultimately.
Yeah. There's another factor, of course, as well, in that both the Daily Mail and the Reach Group newspapers are losing sales dramatically. Reach have made 400 people redundant recently, and the Mail, we know, has declining sales. So the power of the right-wing press may be quite substantially on the wane.
Yeah, and hey, if people are looking for brand new papers to read, then I know a perfectly good local network that loads of people volunteer at, and also a main paper that have now just made a deal to release physical copies in WH Smith, Sainsbury's, and Waitrose. So yeah. be sure to keep an eye out for those guys.
We haven't seen the hard copies of Bylines Times in the supermarkets yet in Scotland.
Oh, I know. It took a while to get to Bristol, which you think that you know that would be one of the major cities they'd go to first, because you know anti-Tory sentiments is just like sky up sky, you know.
Yeah. I say that, but of course I haven't been in every supermarket, so it could well be they're in parts of Glasgow, in parts of Edinburgh, parts of Aberdeen, etc. But it takes time for these things. I mean, it's only very recently that we've seen on supermarket shelves in Scotland the new European. Being sold and being sold repeatedly, so you know, it's coming back week after week. So it does take time to establish these things.
Of course. Well, I think that concludes this episode of the Bylines Network podcast. Martin, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
This has been the Bylines Network podcast with me, Julian Greenbank, and Chris Davis, and we were joined this week by Martin Roach. The editor was Julian Greenbank and Ben. So please join us next month, where we'll be talking about how Brexit has impacted the lives of the youth.